Hello?
That was a cool thing about the 80s, you know, like, all those movies were like that.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you one way or another.
Every one of my games, I try to do something brand new.
One way or another, I'm gonna see you.
Best time to get someone, man, when they're well fed and had a couple of wines. Welcome to the Retro Project Podcast. My name is Steve. I am your host. Today we have a fantastic guest for you on the show. We have one of the greatest video game programmers of all time, Mr. Howard Scott Warshaw. Before we get into the show, I'd like to let you know where you can find us. You can find us on the Twitter at Retro Project Pod. That's where I do most of my hooting and hollering. You can find us on Facebook at Retro Project Pod. And if you'd like to send us an email or send us any feedback at all, you're more than welcome to. Our email address is theretroprojectpod@gmail.com. You can also find us on iTunes. And if you like the show, if you like the guests, please leave us a review, because the review really, really helps the show out. So let's start at the beginning.
Well, that's where it all begins, yeah.
We had one guy start with the Big Bang.
I was going to say, first the Earth cooled, but I guess I'm a little later down the road than that.
Which means we don't have to cover as much ground.
It's better to have a tightly focused interview, that's true.
So where are you from? Where did Howard Scott Warshaw begin?
Where did I begin? Interesting question. I was born in Colorado, and I was there all of 2 weeks, and then I took my first plane ride. I've always loved flying on planes, and I do believe it's because when I was 2 weeks old, I had my first plane ride. But I went back to New Jersey, which is where my parents were from, and stayed there for 17 years. It was the first 17 years. And then I went to school in New Orleans at Tulane University. Spent a few years there where I got degrees in, math, economics, computer engineering with a minor in theater, had a bachelor in two subjects, a master's in a third. I did all that in 4 years, because I don't like to waste time.
Obviously, And who wouldn't do all of that stuff in 4 years, to be honest?
Exactly. I tried to do it in three, but I just wasn't that quick. And so you have to make certain allowances. And then I headed out to California.
Can I ask one thing?
Please.
Computer science with a minor in theater.
Interesting combination, isn't it? The graduate work was computer engineering. I did the theater with math and economics.
That's still an interesting combo.
Oh, absolutely. You don't expect theater to come along with a hardcore nerd, but which is kind of funny, because actually nerds are very into drama. It's just they're by and large, other people find it very boring drama. Drama nonetheless.
Out of everything, the theater is the one that sticks out the most. Like, what is it drew you towards the theater side of things, and were you expecting to use that in any way after you graduated?
Well, the main thing was, it goes back to my philosophy of going to school, which is concentrate things. You know, some people say, try everything, spread yourself out and have a broad array of everything and sample everything. And I say, that's baloney. I say, what you do is focus and concentrate and let the work reinforce itself so you can do stuff quicker, because the knowledge is supporting itself instead of having to learn a bunch of different unrelated things all at the same time. So I decided theater would be my concentration for humanities, to meet my humanities requirement. So there's that aspect of it. The other aspect of it is I have a real penchant for performance, and I'm a big ham, and, you know, so theater comes very naturally to me, but so does math and science and things like that. So here's the thing. What you're getting at already, what I'm hearing you say is, you know, gee, Howard, that's kind of an esoteric and unusual combination of studies and areas of interest. And that's true. So what's interesting is that, you know, as an economist, I was sort of an unusual economist. And as a computer scientist, well, I was kind of an unusual computer scientist. And in theater, I was kind of an unusual actor and theater practitioner. But most people who are really in theater are kind of unusual to begin with, so it didn't really stand out as much there. And basically, when I was in the School of Arts and Sciences, people tell me, you know, there's something odd about you here, because maybe you should be more like an engineer or something. And then when I was in engineering, people would go, you know, you don't really get this engineer thing. You should probably be more like an arts and science kind of guy. And when I was growing up in New Jersey, people told me, you know, you should probably be in California because you sure don't belong here. So sort of anywhere I went, when I was at Hewlett-Packard, I worked at Hewlett-Packard for a while. And they all said, you know, you are a lot more fun than the average person who works here. It's like, and why are you here? And then when I got to Atari, when I first got to Atari, one of the first things they said to me was, you know, we think you're a little too straight and reserved to work here. So people always get the idea that I don't seem to really fit their idea of what I should be in the situation. But, you know, I talked my way into Atari. I had to overcome the resistance. And it turned out I was definitely someone who should have been at Atari. Right?
You were, like, there very, very early on.
Pretty early, not like open the doors early. But, you know, Atari started in 72, started to really come into its own in 75 or 76. Warner bought them in the late 70s. I got there in 81.
You got there later than I actually thought you did. For some reason, in my head, Yaz is always one of the early releases because it's always been a part of the Atari catalog. You know when something's a classic and
true.
You just think, in your head, you just always think, well, it's just always been there.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. I really kind of like that. I like hearing that. Yaz was my first game. And that was done in 81. And Yaz is, I've always been very proud of Yaz Revenge. I'm not ashamed to say.
I really
like doing Yaz. Well, thank you. But I mean, but Yaz Revenge, one thing about Yaz Revenge was it established a lot of firsts. There were a lot of things that were done for the first time in Yaz Revenge that no one had ever done. Because once again, okay, so here's another case of Howard's the Weirdo. You know, the thing is, I'm always accused of not quite fitting in, not quite being right for what's going on, and yet I still tend to do things very well. So people can't say, you know, you don't really fit in here and you're not very good, so we think you should just go. What people say is, you know, you seem to do this well, and we don't understand why, because you don't do it like other people do it. and I've always posed that conundrum, right, for people. And people who try to put me in a box, people who try to categorize me, are frequently frustrated.
It must do people's head in because they're thinking, oh, here comes Howard, all right, you know, doesn't quite fit in here. And then you keep pulling these kind of things, like, you know, straight out of the box. It's like, here you go, this is what I've got. And then suddenly people are like, oh, geez, he may not fit in, but he does it well. And how do you react to that?
It kind of tickles me. There's an aspect of it that could be depressing, but I try not to take it that way. The way I look at it is I've always wanted to be someone who's hard to define for some reason because I don't want to be limited. So I try to live a life that's really, I have a very ordered brain, but I have a very disordered outward demeanor and appearance. It's hard for people to register how I do stuff because I do stuff in different ways. So I practice science like an artist, which is hard for scientists to understand. And I tend to practice art like a scientist, which is kind of hard for artists to understand because I think a balance of science and art is very important in absolutely everything we do, right? Because to me, science and art are not endeavors. Okay, science and art are points of view. They're approaches. They're ways of dealing with things. With science being a regimented, rigorous, formal, structured approach to things, and art being a more holistic, experiential approach and a way of dealing with things. And they're just different ways. So anything... See, people talk about some stuff is science and some stuff is art. Some classes are science classes and some classes are art classes, right? See, and I've never really bought into that. I think that you can approach something artistically or you can approach it scientifically, and any endeavor can be done either way. And I've always enjoyed walking the line between both because it's hard for me to pick one because they both have real value for me.
This may explain one of the things that you're most famous for, which is your Easter eggs. You're almost like an artist who is signing his work.
Exactly. I look at Easter eggs as signatures.
Like, literally, one of your Easter eggs is your initials.
Oh, my initials are in every one of my games. Absolutely. In fact, what I did was I got to the point by my second game, Raiders, where what I would do is I would make sure at least one, because some of them had multiple signatures or multiple Easter eggs. And so what I do is I got to the point where I decided, you know, Yar's Revenge is HSWWSH, which has a real significance in terms of interpreting the meaning of the backstory of the game. And the other ones have an HSW2 or an HSW3, has an HSW with the number of the game it was in my repertoire, in my history.
You mentioned Raiders, and I really have to bring something up with you there, man. I wasted so much time as a kid playing that game. Starting over, starting from scratch.
Really? Oh, I'm sorry it was a waste.
No. I mean, as in, you know, when you're a kid, and that's
I know what you're saying. I just couldn't resist.
When you're a kid, that's what you do. You waste time. And this was one of my favorite ways to do it. It was just...
Oh, I prefer to think of it as spending time unproductively.
Yeah, oh, I was doing that a lot as well. And I did that with all three of your games. Like, without realizing it, because, of course, there was no... Apart from your Easter eggs and your signings, when you guys made a game back in the day, it's not like on the spine it would say Yar's Revenge, Raiders, E.T. by Howard Scott Warshaw.
No, it wasn't like that. But Yar's Revenge was the first Atari game to have the programmer's name credited in it.
Oh,
did
okay.
You know that?
No, I didn't.
In the, you know, it was the first game that came out with a comic book with a backstory, which I wrote. I wrote the backstory. So Yar's Revenge became the first game in video game history to have a full backstory, which now is a standard thing. But that was the first time it ever happened. And because that was there, they decided they needed to have some credits. So they were doing credits for the comic book, and they thought, well, now they have to credit the game. So in the comic book, if you look in there, I believe you'll see the list of credits. And game programmer is me. You know, it's Howard Scott Warshaw. I said to them, why don't I get credit for the story also, because I also wrote the story, and which they completely redacted and made dumbed down a lot. But it was, they said to me, look, you can have one credit. Do you want credit for the comic book or do you want credit for the game? I said, I'll take the game, please. I thought that was actually a pretty good response on their part. I got to give them credit where credit is due, even when you're talking about credit.
And no one was getting credit in Atari back in the early days. It was always by Atari. And I mean, that's probably something that spurred on guys like yourself and Warren Robinette to actually do these Easter eggs where you got yourself in there. No one knew about it.
Well, there was a need to. There was a need to. Warren Robinette's the guy who invented it, right? Because Warren Robinette put it in Adventure. And everybody had a way of doing it. Some people just put it in the ROM. They put their initials or their name spelled out in ASCII character code in the ROM. The idea was Atari didn't want to acknowledge programmers doing it because they didn't want people poaching their program. So they didn't want people knowing who they were. But the thing was, suppose you go to an interview somewhere, you're going, what have you done? Well, I did this game, I did this game. Well, really? Well, how do we know you did that game? So the thing was, you wanted to have something in your game that you could show someone that nobody else knew about, and that would prove it was your game, right? So a number of programmers would do that. The idea of it was just to validate your identity as the creator. That was the point of it. What I did was I talked to marketing and said, hey, you know, there's value to this kind of thing. It's going to be exciting for players to run into this and find out, and then it creates lore around the game. I want you to know that we're putting this in, and it's a marketing piece. And they went for it. So I had the first marketing-approved Easter egg. All the other ones were secret, and they were kind of, Atari was kind of pissed off about it. I tried to give them the idea that, wait a minute, this is a feature, not a bug, right? This can be a sales point of the game. But they had to get over the idea that we got to hide who the programmers are, but they got over that.
Then you hit up Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, when you got Raiders, was it known that it was going to be the hit that it was? Because obviously, you need to program ahead of the release.
No, back then, we did not program ahead of the release.
Really?
We were lagging. Oh, yeah. If you look at it, the timing, you know, I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark is a early 1982 movie, or maybe 1981 movie.
It would have been, because Empire was 1980.
Empire.
So it was probably 81.
Right, Empire was 80, because I was still at Hewlett-Packard when I saw Empire.
And then Raiders would have been the next year.
Was like 81. And the game was done in 82. It was done in late 81 and early 82. So I'd already seen the movie when I was doing the game. Later on, they wanted to do combined releases. But yep. Raiders of the Lost Ark is the first video game done for a movie. The first time a video game was done from a movie was Raiders of the Lost Ark. That was the first one.
Superman had come out, but Superman wasn't based on the Christopher Reeve stuff in any way.
Right, but Superman was a classic character. Superman wasn't like a new current thing. There was a Superman movie going on around then, but Superman was not a new concept.
Raiders is a fairly it's a fairly abstract game in some ways. Like, there is a lot that you simply have to figure out for yourself.
Absolutely. It's an adventure game. You've got to solve puzzles and figure things out.
Sometimes you don't even know that you're walking into a puzzle until you realize, oh, there's no way out of this. And the great thing about Raiders is every time there's no way out of something, there's a way out of something.
There's a way out. Yeah, I don't like the idea of getting stuck in places. So I always make sure you have an out. You may not be aware of it, but because I also believe that is a life philosophy, right? If you think about it, games tend to reflect the philosophies of their designers, right? You know, when people make up, if you copy a game, then it's not true. But if you're making up a game, if you're creating a game, that game is going to, some of the things that happen and the restrictions and the rewards and the things in that game, they're going to reflect the values of the designer. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. And I believe, you know, there are many times where we feel we're stuck in our life, but you're never really stuck. You just may not understand how to get out of the situation you're in. I mean, that's a fundamental principle for me as a therapist, right? I try to help people to learn and understand that they have more options than they're currently perceiving, and they can exercise some of these options and change their life and, you know, maybe have an improvement.
And there would have been times as a kid where I guarantee you, trying to figure out these puzzles one at a time, a therapist would have really come in handy.
Nicely done. Nicely done. Because, you know, it has been theorized. People ask me a lot, why did I become a therapist? Why did I become a psychotherapist? And because, first of all, they think it's odd that someone who was a programmer became a therapist, because most people do not associate programmers with high people skills. And what I tell them, though, is that the truth is that programmers and therapists are actually very similar, right? If you think about it, we're all systems analysts. It's just that I decided to move on to a much more sophisticated hardware, is the way I put it to people.
You're working with more than 4 or 8K.
Exactly. And I'm trying to work for more than 4 or 8K. It's a challenge, so I really enjoy that. It's also similar in that I think programming, and particularly games programming, is, like I said before, the mixture of art and science, the mixture of technology and aesthetics is very important to me. Most people choose one or the other, but I like both. And therapy is one of the few places that really requires both. It's an art and a science, I think, if therapy is done well. And same thing with game programming. So they actually have quite a bit in common. Yeah. But there's also been the suggestion that particularly, you know, between Raiders and then E.T., people say that I may have created a lot of depression and some anxiety, maybe even some PTSD, right, from the games that I did. And it's kind of interesting to think that maybe what I was really doing was creating a market for myself in advance for when I became a therapist. Or, you know, or the other side of it was I felt so guilty about having done that, I became a therapist to try and address the issue I'd created.
So you have people walk in and it's basically you've got Raiders-based, Yars-based, and ET-based styles of therapy.
Exactly. You have a lot of ET people who need help. It's no question about that.
Well, I got to touch on that. I mean, I was born in 74, so, you know, I grew up in the 80s where we had no internet. We had nothing where there was kind of this instant thing where people could go on and share their opinions. You kind of had to communicate with people in a certain way. Now, I got ET for Christmas that year. Now, until I hit the internet, and, you know, then you start, of course, reading up on things that you loved when you were a kid and stuff like that. I had no idea that there was a backlash against E.T. I used to play that game constantly. Because for me, that was like, looking back, because one of the things I love with gaming to this day, and I still do, is open world. Now, E.T. was one of the first open world kind of games. Now, I'll tell you right now, I don't care what everyone else says and the bandwagon that the internet is. I love DT, and still do. I think it's a game where you have a beginning, you have a middle, you have an end, you have goals, you have obstacles. It's got all of the things that a game actually needed. I had no idea
exactly
that we were living in a world where E.T. was... Cause, I mean, there's some worse games out there than E.T., man. I mean, even just... Not even just in gameplay, but when people do these lists, I always think, has no one seen Custer's Revenge? You know, why is that... why is that game not at the top? Because that's an awful game. That's a terrible game. If you've never played Custer's Revenge, please don't. Leave it.
Actually, no, I'm familiar with Custer's Revenge. I was actually asked to create Custer's Revenge at one point.
Really?
I declined. Yeah, there was the company. There was the company that was looking to create the Triple X video games, and they would contact some of the programmers around, and they called me at one point, and we were unable to reach an arrangement.
I was going to say, even just in terms of the fact that E.T. was finished. E.T. was a complete game. There were games coming out that weren't even finished.
E.T. is the fastest game development probably in history, certainly on the 2600. I don't know that anyone has before or since created a full game. And E.T. is by all means a full game, right? I'm not saying it has no issues, but it's a complete game. And it was done in 5 weeks, right? So I'll put it up against any other 5 week development for the 2600 for sure.
That's awesome. I didn't even think of it as a game that had issues or glitches or anything like that. The first time I figured out what that I'm sure you would have loved more time with that. But the first time I figured out what that little square was and you raised your neck and the countdown started. Hang on a second. This is about to be one of the first games that I have actually completed. Not just kind of played and gotten a higher score on or something like that. E.T. was probably the first game that I ever completed and then started again. Now, I think that there'd probably be a lot of people out there where E.T. was the first game that they actually completed.
Every one of my games, I try to do something brand new.
And that's where we leave the first half of our interview with Howard Scott Warshaw. As you can see, Howard is a fantastic storyteller, and he's got a lot more to tell us about his time at Atari, programming E.T., Yar's Revenge, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and a lot, lot more. Subscribe to us on iTunes so that you don't miss an episode. We've got some amazing guests coming up, and you can also go to iTunes to leave us a rating and a review. So if you like the show, please feel free to do that. You can also find us on Twitter at Retro Project Pod, Facebook at Retro Project Pod, and you can send us an email at theretroprojectpod@gmail.com with any feedback. So until next time, thank you very much for listening, and this has been the Retro Project Podcast.